From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, Kalamazoo's mayor on the one-year anniversary of that shooting rampage.
We seem to be going the opposite direction of, in my opinion, keeping us more safe and helping us really deal with how do we access guns, what are our expectations of those that have them.
Should fruit growers worry about our warm weather?
It would be worse if you had temperatures this far above normal about a month from now, because then the trees would bud out.
A Michigan playwright inspired by his parents' World War II love letters.
Part of the story is that they had only been together about three times before he shipped out. He knew, he proposed, and so all of their courtship was through the letters.
And John U. Bacon on the Red Wings playoff streak.
It's almost certain to end this year, says me.
Those stories and more today on Stateside. But first, the news. Welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thanks so much for joining us on this May-like February 20th. Coming up on today's program, you've heard of the Rust Belt and the Bible Belt. How about the Euchre Belt? Also, a Southeast Michigan man took his parents' World War II love letters and turned them into a play. But first, 1 year ago this day, Kalamazoo found itself in the crosshairs of gun violence. Jason Dalton is charged with a shooting spree that left six people dead and two people badly wounded. Tonight, the city remembers the victims and survivors in a candlelight vigil. Kalamazoo Mayor Bobby Hopewell is here with us now. Mayor Hopewell, 1 year later, how is the Kalamazoo community doing?
You know, we're certainly doing better than that incident. Certainly, we have come far in supporting our victims and our families. And today we have the opportunity to remember all those that have fallen to gun violence in this crazy, crazy, heinous event.
When you and I talked a year ago, I remember you said to us, we never thought we would be on this list. What are your own feelings on this one-year anniversary?
Well, I'm a paramedic by my original trade, and I've seen a lot in my career. And this is a situation where certainly we never thought we'd be in this position. And myself as mayor speaking about individuals that have been killed by gun violence in our city in a mass way. This is not something I ever thought I would be saying, even having been in a public safety career for so long. What I feel today is that our city is, and citizens and all the folks that are here have really done our best to step up for the victims. And, you know, it's not something simple for any of us and any of them to try to figure out a path forward. But I think we've worked to do that.
How did this rampage change Kalamazoo, do you think?
I think it made us understand that we don't live in a bubble. I think there's certainly a better understanding that gun violence and mass gun violence can happen anywhere, and that we really need to be more cognizant to start thinking about what we can do to decrease the occurrences, what we need to do to prepare for an event like this, and how do we support those that are hurting, not just physically, but this is emotional and mental. And so there had to be a lot of new systems put in place in the event this ever happens again, and certainly to support those that have been harmed by this.
What did you learn about the people of Kalamazoo in the days and the months afterward?
What I find so interesting that what didn't surprise me, I guess I would say, is we have been a community that has been there for each other and giving to each other for a long time. We had a tornado in 1980 and certainly other events, fires and what have you. And our response, as I've said over and over, is what defines us. And I think we responded in a way that demonstrates our understanding of the importance of one another and that this community is strong and that we can stand by each other in good and bad times and find a path forward. And that's what I've learned about our citizens. They just are amazing.
And in speaking of response, in what ways has the community come together specifically to support the families of those who were wounded and those who died?
Well, specifically, we're a pretty giving community, and the philanthropic community has come forward. We have a number of funds that are set up to support the families from the time this incident happened to now and beyond. That's one of the things that I think is so impressive about our city is the willingness to give of your time, treasure, and resources to support others. I think that is one of the things that I'm most proud of, that we will always have a way for our victims to reap the benefits of the kind hearts of our citizens.
In this past year, Mr. Mayor, how often have you talked with the two survivors, Tiana Carruthers and Abby Koff? We're wondering if you can tell us how they and their families are faring 1 year later.
Well, I've had more time with Tiana. She's been at a number of events and has gotten around in the community. She's doing really well. She's really been doing a lot of praying for Abby, which is outstanding, and certainly the families of the victims, and just wants all of us to know how much she appreciates the support, and that this doesn't, again, define us as a community. She's really getting better and healthier, and her family, and they're doing well. It's amazing, again, having been a paramedic and understanding blunt force trauma and gun trauma, she is just progressing really, really well. And then as Abby is concerned, we get the reports more and more in the media about her progress. I have not had the opportunity to speak with her much because she's been all over the place in rehab, but I hear that she is doing great.
Jason Dalton is the Uber driver who's charged with these shootings, and he has yet to be brought to trial. Is the community following his legal proceedings?
Oh, I would bet that it is being followed heavily by a lot of us. Certainly, I have the opportunity to talk with the prosecutor on occasion and hear how the progress is going. And then, of course, throughout the media, I think we're all watching this.
What's the feeling on the way things have progressed so far?
Well, I think that all of us don't always understand why it takes so much time. But when you're building a case and having to go all through the processes of the judicial system, I would assume that's the way it works. Again, not being an attorney myself. But I think probably the time and when will we really get to see and understand what went through his head in regards to this crazy incident.
Mayor Hopewell, a year ago when we talked, you said to us you hoped that what happened in Kalamazoo would help to spur a larger conversation about gun violence. And where are we on that front a year later?
I would say, sadly, that these events haven't done what they need to do. I think locally, more conversation and discussion and engagement around gun violence, because we're an urban core community. We know that gun violence has been more prevalent in some areas than in others, and it's not as if we haven't had violence regarding guns. What I'm concerned with is that from a national perspective and even from a state perspective, we seem to be going the opposite direction of, in my opinion, keeping us more safe and helping us really deal with how do we access guns, what are our expectations of those that have them. I think there's reasonable things we can do and also protect the Second Amendment. I'm not a person that feels folks can't and shouldn't have a gun, but I think that we have to be smarter, and that's the challenge. And I think, unfortunately, we haven't found a real good path to get us there.
There's been talk, is there not, about building a permanent memorial to this incident and to the victims and to the survivors. Wondering where you are on that plan and what a memorial might look like.
There are plans. I think there's going to be some announcement today. I don't have a lot of details to share, but I think after today's remembrance, and remember, this is a happy time when you get to remember individuals and keep them in your heart, even with the negativity of the incident. But we do want to have something in this community that represents all those that have fallen.
What do you expect from this evening's vigil?
You know, I just want to hear more about these wonderful people, their lives that they led and their interests, and just get a feel for who they were as people and be able to take that and hold on to it as we go about our life's journey and have the opportunities to continue to remember them.
Kalamazoo Mayor Bobby Hopewell, we want to thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you, Cynthia. Appreciate it.
Temperatures rising, records falling. That's the story from our burst of warm weather. Ernie Astuno is a meteorologist with the National Weather Service. Just how high did the mercury go over the weekend?
We're generally in the upper 50s to low 60s.
For February, we're all pretty happy, I think, as far as the warm weather. And we broke some records?
Yes, there was several of them across the state, especially the southern half of the state.
Yeah, I did see actually, 69 in Detroit with that beat the old record set back over 40 years ago, back in 1976.
Yeah, there was, I believe, 1976, 1930, 1954, and 2000. Those were all Februarys that had similar warm spells in them.
Now, did this burst of warm weather surprise you?
It's unusual, not unprecedented. I think you see something like this maybe once on an average of about 15 years or so. Like I said, there are some precedents to it. 1954 comes to mind. That was very warm February. The last week of February 2000, we had temperatures in the 60s. That was the last time. It was generally that warm for that long in February. So we had we're going to have a solid week here before it turns cold. Saturday, it looks like, should be turning much colder, which, it's unusual to go that long with temperatures well above freezing this time of year.
I have to say, I find myself thinking back to March of 2012 when we had that really long stretch of warm weather and then a freeze, which killed about 85% of Michigan apples and about 90% of tart cherries. So should our fruit farmers worry at all about this warm burst?
This is kind of early for that to really affect the trees, although you will see some movement with the buds, although the ground just recently thawed out, so it would be worse if you had temperatures this far above normal about a month from now, because then the trees would bud out, and that would be a problem like it was back in 2012. But this is kind of early for that. If March behaves itself and you don't see temperatures that dramatically above normal, then they should be okay.
The big word is if, because we are in Michigan, as we know, so there is always the big if.
Right, yeah, and it could turn out that March ends up much closer to normal, which would be good for them.
Did I hear you say we'll be getting the heavy coats back out by next weekend?
Yeah, it drops probably Sunday, especially high temperatures, only low 30s, so 30 degrees colder than it was last weekend.
No open windows next weekend, that's for sure.
not unless you have a gas leak or something.
Ernie Ostuno is a meteorologist with the National Weather Service. Ernie, thanks so much for speaking with us.
All right, thank you.
You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. The Detroit Red Wings spent the weekend trying to work themselves up from the basement of the Eastern Conference and keep their historic postseason streak alive. Back-to-back weekend wins over Washington and Pittsburgh helped, or did they? Michigan Radio Sports commentator John U. Bacon is here. And John, it's very much into the home stretch. The NHL regular season ends April 9th.
And that is true. And they beat the Capitals and the Penguins, number one and two, in their side right now. Very impressive. However, it's not going to matter because they're still dead last in their division.
So you don't see Detroit making it 26 straight?
They have to win about 75% of their games the rest of the way in, which is a tall order. They're not that far off points-wise.
Okay.
The leading team, Montreal, in their division is 31-20. Detroit is 24-25. So on that measure, pretty close. But you got a logjam. Too many teams are in front of you to leapfrog everybody to get there because they're going to win games too. So this, sad to say, the 25-year streak is likely to end this spring. When it does, then you have a draft coming up. Then you got the new building opening up in the fall. The timing could not be worse. And usually when you finish last, the good news is that, hey, you got a draft pick. You got the best guys out there. This happens to be a very weak draft year. Last year's Austin Matthews, who scored 4 goals in his first game for Toronto. And the second coming of Gretzky, they say, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. This year, eh. So
a bad year to get to be in the basement looking for draft picks.
When I was thinking about this topic last night, Cindy, I thought, you know what? I've got almost nothing but bad news here for Red Wings fans, and I apologize for that. But here we are. So the team is not doing well, despite the weekend.
Yeah.
Not going to make the playoffs. I'm not sure who on this team you keep, who do you get rid of. You probably keep Dylan Larkin. Too much upside. Sophomore slump this year, mm-hmm. but looks good for the years ahead, I think. You might trade Thomas Vanek just for the playoffs for somebody else and then get him back. He said he loves playing in Detroit. He's the leading point getter right now, so don't lose him. But a weird thing in the NHL, his contract is up. So you give him to somebody like the Capitals who wants a playoff push. He plays for them for 3 months, 2 months, whatever else. You get him back in the summer because he's a free agent.
Interesting.
So
okay.
You tell the guy, don't move.
Keep the house.
That's right.
Keep the family.
Don't sell the house.
I guess I'm interested. What should the Wings be looking to get in return with this trade deadline coming up? I mean, should they be sellers or should they hold tight?
Sellers. Sellers, you're not going to make it.
All right.
So
sellers, what do you need to get?
You need to get draft picks, but again, the problem there is not very good. You need to get trades also. Perhaps a more proven commodity is a big thing there. You need scoring. The team can't score, and that's been the problem. And losing Datsyuk in the offseason has been killer.
So that's coming back to haunt in a big
way.
So what has most surprised you throughout this season, for better or for worse? Or maybe the word should be who has most surprised you, for better or for worse?
Yeah, I hate to say, is Blashill the head coach. I said in your show last summer, I thought he was going to be a great two summers ago. I thought he was going to be a great addition. And so far, this team has got no identity. Good weekend, I grant you. Not tough enough, not smart enough, take dumb penalties. Erickson is killing him on defense. Again,
well, he's out for the season. So.
I know.
Yeah.
I hate to say it, but his broken wrist, they start winning games.
Yeah.
I don't know what he's got on the organization, but they refuse to trade him. He's got a big contract, and he's not very good.
There's no secret the Wings have had a really horrendous year in terms of injuries
bad
and playing
luck.
So why do you think things have been so bad with injuries, especially compared to other seasons for the Wings?
It's mostly bad luck. What you don't know is who your weight training coach is, does it make a difference, and so on. Some trainers will tell you that if you exercise a certain way, you're more prone to injuries. Some will say if you do it this way, you're less prone to injuries. I'm not in the locker room. I can't say, but that's a factor. It's probably mainly dumb luck.
So looking ahead for this upcoming new season in the new home with pretty poor pickings in the draft, what do you see?
Weak draft. You have a building open up. You hate to open a building up on a down note, and you're going to get one. So it's bad news there. I think, however, the energy generated by the stadium being downtown in a better location than Joe Louis by far. The idea was putting Joe Louis downtown would generate foot traffic downtown. You've got 8 lanes of Jefferson. You might as well build a moat. You've got a building on the river with no windows. You can put it anywhere.
Right.
Don't put a casino on the river either. They don't have windows.
Yeah. No, that's true. That's true. And so, it was interesting with when you contrast with all the reminiscences when Mr. Ilitch passed about the teams that the 4 Stanley Cup winning teams.
Oh yeah.
How things have changed.
They have changed. Look, 25 years is a hell of a run. So it is the NHL record. So hats off to the Red Wings. It's almost certain to end this year, says me. If it doesn't, I'll eat crow on your show very happily.
Michigan Radio Sports commentator John Eubank. And as always, thanks, John.
Thank you, Cindy.
2 young people keeping love alive all throughout World War II with letters, hundreds of letters. That's the story told in a new play from Ann Arbor writer-director David Kiley. The play is I'll Be Seeing You. It's based on his book, Writing the War, Chronicles of a World War II Correspondent. Kiley was here on Stateside in late 2015 talking about the book, a collection of the letters written by his father, Charles, and mother, Billy, throughout their courtship during World War II. David, welcome back.
Thank you so much, Cynthia, for having me.
Let's get back to the book for a little bit before we talk about the play. So after your parents' deaths, you discovered hundreds of their letters?
Well, I knew about the letters before they passed away. My father was very private, and he said that I could do anything I wanted to with them after he was gone. But it took my sister and I some years to edit them. They had to be archived properly because there was, almost 900 of them, all in different forms. Handwriting, some were typed, some were V-mail, which was a thing that some of your viewers might know about. But it was almost like microfilm, kind of having the letter shrunken down into a smaller form so it would be less weight on the airplanes going back and forth.
Quite amazing. It's a story of their love growing, but it's also a story of World War II because your dad was a correspondent for Stars and Stripes. So he saw an awful lot of history in that European theater.
He did see a lot of history. And he took part in a lot of history because the arc of his war was that he went in as infantry, didn't think he was going to be a reporter, but he was a reporter in civilian life. And then they plucked him out. He was in on the invasion of Normandy as a reporter. And then at the end of the war, he was the only reporter allowed in the building for when the German high command was negotiating surrender with Eisenhower's staff.
Amazing. And you turned it into a book. I know I personally love the book. We had you on the show in December 2015, and we had a couple of fine young actors from the University of Michigan kind of interpreting their letters. And then you turned this into a play. Was this kind of always in the master plan for you?
It was in the back of my head. After I had seen the touring show Love Letters, I began to think that this could be something like that. What I've turned it into is quite more than Love Letters, which is usually just 2 actors reading from a binder. This show has 5 actors, Charles and Billy, two radio singers, and a news announcer who's loosely modeled after Edward R. Murrow. I'm very involved in the theater in Michigan, so translating it, the story, to a play just naturally took place in my head.
And it had to have been challenging in a sense that you wrote the book the play is based on. You wrote the play. You're directing the play, your directorial debut. You're in the play, and it's about your mom and dad. So on a lot of different levels, it's a lot of balls to juggle in the air at the same time.
I don't recommend it. I was postering places for the show last weekend as well, so technically I'm the producer too. I don't think I would ever do anything quite this involved and wear this many hats. But I think because it is a real labor and expression of love and so personal that, you know. And when you do it the first time too, it's not like people are coming out of the woodwork to help you. So you actually do need to wear a lot of hats.
To that point, let's listen to an excerpt from I'll Be Seeing You. What are we going to hear?
This is actually the speech or the letter that my father has written to my mother where he mentions Levy and Rose in his letter. And that was, I selected the music for the show based on songs that my parents actually mentioned in their letters. And he's writing from France. Dearest Billy, we have about an hour to spend together tonight before the sun goes down. We have a radio here in the office, which also gives us music all night. We get New York on shortwave occasionally, but mostly it's German stations. Now it's Berlin Betty on the German station, and I could almost love her for playing Ain't Misbehavin'. She sounds like an American, and besides playing records, she also sends messages to the American people from GI prisoners of war. The picture here is not so nice. It was the second time in as many days that I had been up to the front, and most of what I saw will not be passed on to you. Not that you can't take it, but I'd rather not talk about the dead, the dying, the shelling, the snipers, the wounded, and the chaos. Everyone here is talking about when we can push into Paris to liberate the city. One of our French helpers was talking to us about his family. His parents were killed by the Germans here. His sister was beaten. He had our full attention, believe me. His stories were heartbreaking. The radio was on in the background, and just as he paused in his letter, La Vie en Rose came on the radio. It was like a movie on cue. We all just listened and drank from a bottle of champagne he shared from his stash that he'd kept from the Germans. Did I tell you? The water supply is not safe, so we are brushing our teeth with champagne.
Des yeux qui font baiser les miens, un rire qui se perd sous sa bouche, voilà les poudres sans retouche de l'homme auquel j'appartiens. Hold me close and hold me fast, this magic spell you cast, this is la vie en rose. When you kiss me, heaven sighs, and though I close my eyes, I see la vie en rose. When you press me to your heart, I'm in a world apart, a world where roses bloom. And when you speak, angels sing from up. Every day words seem to turn into love songs. Give your heart and soul to me, and life will always be la vie.
Marlene Inman, beautiful, beautiful interpretation of that wonderful, wonderful song. You've been in a lot of productions from South Pacific to Fiddler on the Roof, Les Mis, you were Madame Thénardier. What has it been like for you working with David, bringing his parents' love story from World War II to the stage?
Oh, that's been wonderful. It was so exciting to be part of an original project, and that it's based on a true story is even more special. And David is a good friend of mine, and so being a part of this has been very special.
What are some of the numbers people are going to hear through the show?
Lily Marlene, Marlena Dietrich piece or tune, is another favorite of mine. The White Cliffs of Dover also. And then some from our male radio singer, we have Ma, I Miss Your Apple Pie. and of course, I'll Be Seeing You is in the show as well.
Beautiful, beautiful songs when you think about it. And David, I know the profits from the play are going to go to EncoreMichigan.com, which you run. Tell us a little about Encore Michigan.
It is the only media source left in Michigan that covers all of the live professional theaters. Now, we are well aware of the touring shows that come through the Opera House, Fisher Theater, et cetera, et cetera. But there are, at any given time, about 75 to 80 active professional theater companies around the state, and they just don't get covered anymore by what's left of the dailies and the websites and things like that. So we preview, review. We have a great show calendar on our website. We do audition information for actors. We're kind of one-stop shopping for all the live professional theaters. But we also gotten some help from some sponsors like Xfinity and Comcast. But we operate in the red. And so until we can get more grant money and sponsorship money, and advertising revenue, I'm doing things like this to help fund it.
So this is going to premiere on February 24th, 25th, and 26th at the Arthur Miller Theater in Ann Arbor. But I suspect this is like planting a seed. What kind of plans do you have in the back of your mind as you think about what you'd like I'll Be Seeing You to be able to do?
We're in the 75th anniversary of our involvement in World War II. And this show is actually written and designed to be what I call a pop-up show. It's entirely done on book. So that means that a theater who might be doing long runs and has a couple of dark weekends in between runs could easily put this up for a weekend run. And so we're videotaping it for the purposes of trying to get licensed out, because I think it really is a good story. It's both educational and entertaining, which is hard to combine into one thing. It's a love story that also reminds us, I think, of one of the times in our recent history, although 70 years ago, when the country was really together, pulled together, people of every stripe, different religions, different political stripes, all pulled together in one cause. And I think we need some of that, and I think the audiences are looking for some of that too, I hope.
And a wonderful love story, because ultimately, Charles and Billy were married how many years?
56 years.
Yeah.
And, you know, part of the story is that they had only been together about three times before he shipped out. He knew, he proposed, and so all of their courtship was through the letters. And I hope we've captured not only Charles's war in Europe, but Billy's war on the home front, because she had a very iconic, emblematic home front war where she was a Red Cross volunteer, she was an airplane spotter, she worked in a defense factory, really kept the home fires burning.
Well, it was a wonderful book, Writing the War, Chronicles of a World War II Correspondent. Now it has taken its next step out into the world as the play I'll Be Seeing You. And again, it'll have its premiere February 24th, 25th, and 26th at the Arthur Miller Theater in Ann Arbor. And I know you can get all the details at EncoreMichigan.com.
If I could mention one thing, we got a grant from Nissan North America that I'd like to make known to the veterans in your audience. We have a block of free tickets. And even when we exhaust the block of free tickets, you know, if more veterans than we have tickets for inquire, that's a good problem to have, and I'll take care of it. But you can find the details at EncoreMichigan.com, or you can go to BrownPaperTickets.com and just plug in I'll Be Seeing You, and that'll give you all the information, too.
Fantastic. David Kiley, Marlene Inman, and, of course, Leah Fox, the wonderful accompanist, thank you so much for being with us on Stateside.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, Cynthia.
You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty.
Entrepreneurship.
Part of the community. The next idea.
We are the key to our own recovery.
You can't rebuild your home or your neighborhood without tools, but tools cost money. Here's a solution, a community tool sharing program. An idea called Shovel Share does exactly that, and it's a finalist in the Night Cities Challenge. Lydia Ray Levinson is from Michigan Community Resources, the group that came up with Shovel Share. Lydia, welcome to The Next Idea.
Hi, thank you for having me.
This is so interesting. How would Shovel Share work?
It would be a network, a citywide network of 7 tool sharing centers located across the city of Detroit, and one would be in each council district. They would be operated by different community development organizations that would be local to the neighborhood in which they're located. And groups and residents would have access to different tools, materials, and training opportunities that would allow them to participate directly in the stabilization and revitalization of their own neighborhoods.
So how would that work for an individual homeowner? Let's just say that there is a project that needs doing at the house.
Well, what's really innovative about it is the online web portal that we're going to have. So if someone had internet access, they could log in online to see if, say, the hammer or the shovel that they needed was available at their local center. If it wasn't, it would show which other center would have that tool that day. And if you don't have internet access, you could go right to the host organization and check it out yourself in person.
So who would fund buying all these tools?
It would be funded through the Night Cities Challenge.
So that's why you're hoping that you wind up winning. I know you're a finalist right now. What kind of tools might be in this neighborhood toolbox?
So home repair equipment and also anything needed to maintain vacant homes or vacant lots. So things like lawnmowers, hammers and saws, plywood to do board ups on vacant homes, as well as anything you need to do, you know, masonry, tuck pointing, roof repair.
How would you make sure that people knew how to use the tools?
So we're going to have a partner. We have two partners, actually, and one of them is Michigan Historic Preservation Network, and they already do a lot of education around different types of home repairs. They offer like a host of different classes that include masonry repair, roof repair, porch repair, an assortment of others. So they will be holding classes in each of the 7 districts. They'll be holding workshops and then producing 1-to-3-page informational pamphlets. We also anticipate existing organizations and workforce development programs being able to access the tools and use them that way. So that's an even broader educational opportunity available.
One has to wonder if something like this might even help spark interest among young people in maybe some of the building trades.
We really hope so. Yeah, providing access to groups and individuals is the way to go.
Now, all of that stuff can actually take up a lot of room, and sometimes things can get stolen. What are the plans to deal with tool storage?
So the tools will be kept in repurposed shipping containers, and these are actually, this is an approach that's used to hold equipment by a lot of different organizations throughout the city. The containers are, they're made out of steel, and they are virtually impenetrable. People have even tried ramming their cars into them and have been unsuccessful. So that's where they'll be stored. In terms of tools getting lost or broken through use, that's where our other partner comes in, IOBI, which stands for In Our Backyard. They are a nationwide crowdfunding platform. So each of the tool sharing centers will be able to raise ongoing funds to keep replenishing tools as needed and to buy additional tools if they find that they need a tool that's not in their initial inventory.
Lydia, it's a very interesting idea. Who came up with this?
This is something that my organization, Michigan Community Resources, has been looking at for years. In the 2014 Blight Task Force report that was commissioned by the White House, there was a recommendation that MCR, my organization, actually set up some tool sharing centers throughout the city to help groups maintain vacant lots. And we have revisited this idea over and over, and it's had many different incarnations. And we finally feel like we've landed on the most efficient and impactful one over the last 3 years.
Is anyone else doing this in Detroit or anywhere in Michigan that you know of?
So throughout the city of Detroit, there are some informal and formal tool sharing centers. There's a really successful network of tool sharing centers that focuses on agricultural tools, so things for community gardens and urban farms, but they don't have general home repair tools. And that's operated by an organization called Keep Growing Detroit, and it's through their garden resource program. But there's also a lot of community development organizations that are maybe hosting tools for their local community, but there's no formal network that's citywide for home improvement tools, and there's no online platform like what we're proposing.
How do you see this shovel share building on existing strengths in Detroit neighborhoods, Lydia?
It's going to connect residents and community groups to resources and to one another, and it's going to build their capacity to tackle challenges in the neighborhood. We're hoping that it will create stewards that are taking pride of ownership in their neighborhoods. You know, Detroiters are a resilient group, and they've been maintaining vacant homes, maintaining historic structures, and maintaining vacant lots on their own for a long time. This is just filling the gap, giving groups access to resources they might not otherwise have.
And you just think of kind of that intangible benefit of being able to, you know, wield that hammer or make that repair yourself to your own home.
Exactly. But it's also going to expand economic prospects for Detroiters. We're hoping it translates into, like you were mentioning, new job opportunities through the access to physical tools and the educational offerings that we're prepared to host. And we're hoping that's going to generate human capital, develop skills and experience with home rehab and neighborhood revitalization, particularly among youth, as you mentioned. It's also going to increase the capacity of community development organizations to forge new connections both with and between residents. And we're hoping that that will collectively strengthen existing neighborhood conditions, which might even contribute to increasing local property values and stabilization and increase population, attracting more talented people and keeping those talented folks that we already have.
And it strikes me that whatever you learn in Detroit could be easily taken and applied to other cities around Michigan.
Absolutely. And that's one of our intentions, is to develop kind of a curriculum out of this. You know, it's not going to be one size fits all. Different communities and different neighborhoods have different needs, and they have different levels of vacancy and different types of housing stock. But we're really intending to take our best practices that we identify and the framework and make it widely available for other groups that are interested in replicating it.
So, Lydia, how would people be able to access and find ShovelShare online?
So it's part of our Neighborhood Exchange web-based platform and suite of services that are set up to connect and engage neighborhood groups and residents through things like discussion forums, educational workshops, additional resources that build their capacity. And it really is a platform that supports peer-to-peer learning so that groups and individuals can learn from one another and expand their networks across different neighborhoods.
And what's the website?
It's neighborhood-exchange.com.
It is really an interesting idea, and you'll have to let us know how things develop should you win that grant and how things take off. Lydia Ray Levinson is from Michigan Community Resources, the group that came up with the Shovel Share idea, a community tool sharing program. Thank you so much for being with us on The Next Idea, Lydia.
Oh, you're very welcome. Thank you for having me.
Support for The Next Idea on Stateside comes from Michigan Economic Development Corporation, committed to marketing Michigan to drive job growth and investment in our communities. MichiganBusiness.org.
You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Get a group of Michiganders together and a deck of cards. Add that, mix it all up, and chances are pretty good you're going to wind up with a game of euchre. It was once dubbed the queen of all card games, and it was wildly popular in this country in the late 1800s. But its popularity waned through the 20th century, except here in Michigan and a handful of Midwestern states. Yes, folks, we live in the euchre belt. Just what is it with Michiganders and euchre? Jason Vogue is a journalist and euchre enthusiast who's written about the people's card game. Good to have you with us, Jason. I love the point you made in the piece you wrote for theall.com. You say, if poker promotes cutthroat enterprise, then euchre embodies small-town communalism. How so?
Oh, euchre, when I learned it, I mean, you play with four people, and you have a partner. And that whole time, you have to work with that partner, you have to share your thoughts, you have to share points with your partner, and only way you will win is to work with your partner. And it really strikes me as something that's the opposite of poker. I mean, poker, you just want to get rid of everybody at the table. And I think in the last 20, 25 years, poker has really become the American card game. And I think it's sad that we've lost touch with our euchre past, this very communal, sharing game that you work with other people and play with a partner through the whole game.
Now, when did you start playing, Jason?
I started playing in middle school. I was in the band. I was playing the flute, and I learned how to play playing on top of trumpet cases in band camp and places like that. And it was just this wonderful game. My parents played it. My grandparents played it. Everyone in my family played it. So I always wanted to learn it. And the best way to learn it is with friends that are kind of learning along with you. So we sat in endless hours while traveling on buses or waiting for band meets to start, things like that. We would just play over and over. And I think the best thing I learned from those days was how to tell a story. I mean, you're sitting there with four people, and it's a very communal, like I said, game. And it's also a very conversational game. You're talking the whole time. Talking is very important. It both kind of helps you razz the other players, but also it helps you kind of keep things going. And so I learned how to tell stories and just be a person talking to other people. And those are wonderful days, and I would love to have them back.
And I'm thinking that it probably helped connect you with your parents and your grandparents and all the family members. If everybody was playing, you were able to be part of that.
Oh, my gosh, yeah. I come from this corner of Michigan near Westphalia, Fowler, Ionia, Michigan. It's this nest of very old immigrant German Catholic villages where I grew up. And so, yeah, I mean, many of our grandparents and great-grandparents still spoke German. All of these people came over here right at the end of the 19th century, moving to Michigan. They came down through Canada, and they brought euchre with them. So this game has been passed down by German immigrants for many, many years, and it's one of my favorite pieces of my heritage.
You know, you live in L.A. now. Does anyone from L.A., not transplanted Michiganders, but anybody that came from elsewhere, do they even know what the word euchre means?
This is the funniest thing about Los Angeles is there are tons of, these aren't transplanted Michiganders, but people who attended the University of Michigan. It's a very special crew out here in Los Angeles. There's a lot of us. I was a University of Michigan graduate myself, and all University of Michigan graduates that I've met out here know how to play euchre and get really excited when I talk about it. But everybody else from California kind of gives me a confused stare when I bring up euchre. But I've played euchre out here with a number of University of Michigan alumni. I think wherever the University of Michigan Alumni Network reaches out to, you're going to be able to find a euchre game, no matter where you live.
In reading what you wrote, the People's Card Game for theall.com, you really spelled out the interesting history, and euchre was huge in this country. So what knocked it off the top of the heap as far as games that America loved to play?
Yeah, well, there's two things. In the 1950s, bridge became very popular. I think it's very hard for people to imagine this, but bridge used to be the most popular game in America. There was a TV show on ABC about playing bridge. It's I think, kind of mind-boggling to think that bridge would be that popular. It's a very difficult game. I've struggled my whole life to learn how to play it.
I had a mother. I had aunts. That was their game, was bridge.
Yeah. It's crazy, and that's the partner game that kind of took over. I mean, it requires a lot more brain power and a lot more calculation than euchre does itself. So, yeah, I think it just kind of it became very fashionable, and there were books. Every newspaper would run things about it. So that was the first blow. That knocked euchre down the charts, as it were. In the 19th century, euchre was maybe the second most popular card game, and then after that, it kind of plunged down in the 50s. And by the time I was a child, euchre was probably like the seventh or eighth most popular card game.
Interesting. Yeah, in fact, I'm remembering Omar Sharif had a daily thing in the paper. His little bridge column. It was all about the bridge. That is
exactly.
So funny.
Yeah, and it totally eclipsed euchre. And then I think the other killing blow is poker has really just captured the American imagination in the last 20 years. I mean, you see it on TV now in the same way that bridge once did. Now you can see poker on all sorts of different television stations. There's books. There's online. It's just become a machine. And I think that it's a little sad, but I think the kind of cutthroat nature of poker has taken over our culture in a way, and that's kind of bumped euchre, this communal game, out of the picture a little bit. And this is what kind of got this whole article started rolling, is there's this euchre belt. It's the Midwestern players in Illinois, Indiana, Kentucky, Michigan, Ohio, and Pennsylvania. The game has stayed alive among this little tight-knit group of people, and it kind of tracks where these German immigrants kind of moved through the United States.
Is it because of that family roots where you could say mom played it, grandma played it? And because I mentioned euchre just in our office, and immediately everybody started chiming in about, you know, parents playing, and we play, all kinds of views about euchre just within our little office. And it got me wondering, you know, so what is it with Michigan and euchre?
you hit it on the head with the family part. I mean, we all had family members. If you live in the euchre belt, someone in your family knows how to play it, and they taught you how to do it. I mean, you can play euchre online. You can play euchre with an app, but it's not the same. I mean, it's funny if you go just read the customer reviews. People get very upset when they're playing euchre with a computer because a computer can never replace the power and the joy of playing with another person. You just can't replace that, and it's this really kind of communal game. And it's fun, and it's just kind of embedded in our culture, I think, a little bit. One really interesting thing, the most powerful card in euchre is called the Bower. It's the Jack. And when a Bower is trump, when the trump Jack is played, it can take anything else in the game. So it's the most powerful card. Interestingly enough, a lot of euchre scholars think that is an Americanization of the word Bower, the German word for farmer or peasant.
Huh.
So built into this game, it's overturning the social order. Usually kings are the highest, the queens are the highest, but this game says, hey, the farmer, the peasant, the people, the salt of the earth, we are the most powerful card and we can win. And that's always, that was really exciting when I found that kind of embedded in the game. And I think that's part of the reason it's spread from family to family to family. I mean, there's some pride built into that.
Is euchre on the endangered species list, do you think, Jason?
Oh, no, never. I would honestly say, I mean, just by the response that I've received to this, and then even if you look in the App Store, I mean, it's in the top 1,000 games in the Apple App Store. Plenty of people can play. I mean, any time of day, if you want to play euchre, you can just turn on this Apple app and play digitally with people all over the world. So I think as long as the internet is alive, you will be able to play if you're separated from euchre communities. But in the places like Michigan where people play euchre, it will never die out, because I'm going to teach my daughter. She's 6, maybe one more year, 2 more years, and I will teach her for sure. And every time she goes home to Michigan, or every time she hangs out with my community here from the University of Michigan, she'll play euchre with those kids. I mean, it's one thing that kids do to pass the time. And so I think as long as families are passing the card game from generation to generation, it will never die out, even if it's not the queen of card games anymore.
Jason Bogue, his piece at intheall.com is worth reading, The People's Card Game. Thanks for sharing your love of euchre. And it's great to talk with a fellow band geek, because we rock.
Oh, yes, we do rock, and it's so great to be here, and thanks for talking about this. I think it's one of my favorite topics to talk about in the whole world.
Thanks, Jason.
All right, thank you.
Today, Stateside was directed by Mike Blank. Our engineer is Bob Skahn. Stateside's executive producer is Joe Lindstroff. Contributors are Allie Billings, Mercedes Mejia, Lindsay Scullin, Josh Hakala, Cass Adair, Lise Messmer, and Nick Wallace. Stateside's a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so much for listening.
Support for The Next Idea on Stateside comes from Michigan Economic Development Corporation, committed to marketing Michigan to drive job growth and investment in our communities. MichiganBusiness.org.